Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was born in Port of Spain, Trinidad, and educated in the UK. She's the author of six novels and a memoir. Four of her award-winning novels are set in Trinidad and the Caribbean region. The White Woman on the Green Bicycle was shortlisted for the Orange Prize in 2010 and the Encore Award in 2011. Archipelago won the OCM Bocas Award for Caribbean Literature in 2013 and was shortlisted for the Orion Award in 2014. House of Ashes, published in 2014, is a novel drawn from historical events and tells the story of a botched coup d'etat. It was shortlisted for the Costa Fiction Award in 2015 and longlisted for the OCM Bocas. Her erotic novel, The Tryst, was published in July 2017, and her memoir, With the Kisses of His Mouth, traces a personal journey of midlife sexual self-discovery. It's an incredibly honest and authentic feeling book. But now, her new book, The Mermaid of Black Conch, has just won the Costa Book Award of 2020. She also teaches creative writing. Monique Roffey, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Hi. I should say welcome back because you've actually been on this programme before. And I wanted to talk to you again because of this momentous win. Winning the Costa for this new book, The Mermaid of Black Conch. And the book is such a delight and it throws up so many interesting things. But winning the Costa is pretty life-changing, isn't it?
It has been life-changing, but I guess it's been over a month now, and it's only now that I'm beginning to feel and see how life-changing it is. Initially, it was just a big shock and lots of action and flurry and excitement. But yes, it's going to open doors and give the book wider scope and readership. Yeah, it's fascinating to see what the impact of this of a prize like this has on a creative work. Yeah.
I mean, the reason I went through all those awards that you've been shortlisted for or won before is just to show that actually there is a difference then, isn't there, from being shortlisted to winning. It does change things completely.
Absolutely. And not only that, when I'd won the novel category in the Costa, I thought that was good. I thought, well, I've won this now. I've won the novel category. But it didn't really change things. It was only for 3 weeks. But in those 3 weeks, it wasn't like the industry and the press came, you know, galloping forward and all, you know, wanted me. It took winning the whole thing before things started to dramatically change. And that's also telling, you know, I'm a working writer. I've been writing for 20 years. I know dozens, if not 100 writers personally. And I've been working for Avon and teaching, and I've just been out there in the world of writing for years. I had no idea how big it needs to be before big things change.
Well, we're going to talk about the book in some detail in a moment, but I just wanted to quickly do a backtrack on who you are. So you were born in Trinidad, but your parents were British, is that right?
My father was British. My mum is a much more complicated background in that she's, well, I had my DNA tested. She's Maltese Italian, but family had emigrated to Egypt. So my mum is a kind of colonial mixed up background in that she was trilingual from birth, speaking Arabic, French and Italian. And then they were basically left the country before the Suez Crisis happened, where they were all forced to leave the country. So she's been, you know, this kind of colonial mixed up, then a refugee, a family were made refugees, and then sort of emigrated to the Caribbean. She still lives in the Caribbean.
And so that, what, makes you a white West Indian?
Yes, it does.
And so you've written about that, and that sort of feeling, I guess, of alienation and otherness in your book, White Woman on a Green Bicycle.
Yeah. I think in that book, I'm trying to tackle my positionality as a white European ex-colonial, trying to sort of tackle that head on. I think that's what that book is about. And there are numerous books like that written by other white Caribbean people like me. And I've seen other writers do what I did, which is going, okay, I need to tackle this. Whereas The Mermaid, I think, goes way beyond me tackling my family. But yes, that is a book about, you know, my family coming, trying to work it out, trying to fit in, never leaving, becoming part of things over time. Yeah.
House of Ashes was based on a real event.
Yeah, sure. So in 1990, there was an attempted coup d'etat in Trinidad, and it was a messy affair, and the perpetrators were never really incarcerated or punished because of our legal system. And they were released. They are linked to, you know, a big bulging crime. The perpetrator's still free. People died. Port of Spain was, you know, ablaze for 6 days. And so I tackled what happened, yeah.
Mm. Then we get to your really affecting memoir with The Kisses of His Mouth. And that came after a relationship breakdown. It's terribly honest about sex, about feelings. And actually, from there on in, I guess you've been known as quite a sexual writer.
Well, Georgina, it's now 10 years since I published that book. And I mean, I'm proud of it. I think I'm probably most proud of that book, of all my books, because of the type of feedback, because so many women and even some men have said, you know, that it's, you know, had a life-changing effect on them. You know, I was more naive and fresher writer then, a fresher person. And that was my way in, to be really candid. And it's in the spirit of all good memoir writing. I mean, if you look at the works of loads of female writers, in particular, I'm thinking of Viv Albertine and her Clothes, 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 Music, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys. There are so many writers who are just as frank and just as honest and, you know, just as transparent as I've been. And I guess, you know, I read a lot of memoir, and I think that's what it takes. You know, you either do it well. I mean, you know, people have told me about the Michelle Obama memoir, which is really, really, you know, doesn't go there. It's just a sort of sweet little kind of, you know, it's nice. It's a nice, nice book, but no big secrets. And I think, you know, to be honest, you've really got to go there or don't go there.
Mm. Because you actually teach memoir and life writing.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
So, I mean, that horrible phrase, everyone's got a book in them, and I always add, and sometimes that's where it should stay. Do you think that, I mean, obviously we've all got our own story to tell. Can we all tell it?
No, in a short story, you need some help. I launched a new course with the National Writers' Centre. It's called Introduction to the Memoir, and I'm only in my second course. It's only been running for two courses, but it's attracted some real naturals. Like, some of the people on the last course, I was like, you must have been writing before. Surely you've done some creative writing classes. And two or three of these women had never written anything before. They've just got a strong instinct and they're reading a lot. But I mean, to write, you need to be a sophisticated reader to start with, because then you understand what we're talking about when we talk about writing. I mean, if you want to be a good painter and decorator, you know, you've got to learn what you do. You've got to know about paint and damp and mould and all this stuff about walls. So, yes, there is definitely craft in writing, and you need to go and find out what that is. Mm. Yeah.
And also, I mean, where does the line come between, you've chosen to be very, very honest in your book, as you say, Obama didn't. How far can you go? And particularly when it affects other people.
I think you've got to make the lion's share of the story yours and be prepared to expose yourself and leave other people behind. It's not an act of revenge or an act of justice. I mean, if somebody's hurt you badly enough that they've broken a law, then go to the police. You know, if you're talking about historical abuse, why wasn't that person reported to the police? You still can report someone to the police historically. So I always say, get the legalities of things straight and also work out your motive for writing. So really, at best, a memoir should be a kind of self-help book for other people. You know, so you're really writing to help others, as opposed to, you know, set the record straight for yourself and, you know, make yourself look good and better and change events. And, you know, if someone's hurt you badly, you know, get over it. Go to therapy or the police, but don't write a memoir.
Yeah. Let's talk about Triss, because that was your erotic novel. Mm. And it was a delightful novel. But as I say, cemented you more firmly in this realm of the sexual writer.
Mm. Well, I started writing that when I was about 36, and it was published when I was 52. So, yeah, it took years for me to, in some way, process and ingest the shame around the sex that I was writing about, and the sex I was writing about was so common. I had a celibate marriage, I had a celibacy within marriage, and I was very young, and I didn't understand it, and I was ashamed to talk about it. And it took me years to process this shame. And I eventually found a way to do it, which was inventing this kind of magical character and working with myth. And it's very sexually explicit. And again, things come out of me that I think, oh gosh, I don't know if I'd write that today. Or, you know, I look at both my sex books and I'm proud and also quite impressed, shocked. You know, I'm like, gosh, I look at both those books and I make myself blush.
In a way that The Mermaid of Black Conch is absolutely the right book to come after that, because we've got a mythical character again. I perhaps would call it more of a love story than a sexual story. But tell us, I know it was born from a number of different sources. Tell us about that.
Well, I think what happened to me was I started dreaming this mermaid up after I'd spent some time watching a fishing competition in Tobago. But then humanity has been dreaming mermaids up for millennia. So it was a sort of specific thing that I dreamt up. But it's very universal. She's such this sort of very powerful pre-Christian water goddess that is everywhere in the world. She's pan-global. So it wasn't, I mean, I thought about her and thought about her and thought about her a lot. And then eventually I came across the myth of Aikaia and the Taino myth. And that's when I thought, aha, I've got a story, and the story could do with a rewrite. Because like many old stories, young women have to get taught a lesson, or young women are the victim of jealousy or rivalry or, you know, bad, malevolent, maleficent energies. And also old women. And in this Taino myth, it's again, I was interested in, it's the old woman and the young woman. They're both a problem. They're both problematic. One is too young, sexy, that's problematic. One is too old, she's not useful anymore. They both got cursed in the myth. You know, Angela Carter's one of my favourite writers who's been also rewriting myths for the 21st century.
Yeah. And so, I mean, just to kind of lay the groundwork, this is about a mermaid, as the title would imply, and also about how she could be integrated or reintegrated into modern life when she clearly comes from a very, very ancient past. And that's what the book examines. Now, it's interesting that you talk about how mermaids have been cursed by other women, because what I really wanted to talk about here was this whole thing about, you know, we're so full of the sisterhood and we're all supporting each other and all the rest of it, but there is such a history of women hating women.
Well, again, if you unravel it, you'll still find the patriarchy. You know, what is female rivalry? It's usually rivalry over a man. It's usually in some way part of a non-matrifocal society. You know, these myths come out of an old patriarchy. It's a dark story about womanhood.
And how far do you think that reflects where we are now as modern women? Have we become more supportive?
I feel as though we've now in the West had four waves of feminism, and the fourth wave is really linked to this idea of intersectionality. So finally, we've gone from, you know, rising up, claiming the vote, to, oh my God, women are different, we're all not the same, let's all separate and fracture and fight each other. And then I think we've got to a place where intersectionality, you know, when Audre Lorde said, we're not free until we're all free. I think we're getting there. I definitely think we're getting there. Yeah.
Then there's the whole sort of post-colonial side of this novel. So one of the characters, Miss Rain, is, like you, a white West Indian, and her family owns most of the island. And she goes through a journey, I don't like using that word, but you know what I mean, where she does have to confront that. And so there is a whole sort of element of, I guess, of post-colonial guilt in there too.
Well, she's very much part of, she can't shake off her history. Her history comes with her as her own curse. She's tried to deal with it as best she can by using her privilege to sell off land, and she doesn't collect the rent, but she is who she is. And it's cost her her lover. And it's cost her the love of her life, who grew up to be a proud artist, who left, you know, because he can't live here with her and who she is and what she represents. So who she is and what she represents causes her a lot of pain and a lot of isolation and a lot of heartbreak. But there is something that both her and life, you know, there is something powerful, which is obviously love. They love each other and have loved each other all their lives. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to throw in there as well, is don't underestimate, I mean, it's going to sound corny, but don't, you know, in where I come from in Trinidad, I mean, people are brown, and I see a lot of mixed race love children and couples, and people get it together. And that's a process of creolization. And I wanted to write about that, about love. It's not spoken about or written about enough. I mean, if you didn't know about it, if you only listened to the academics, you would come to Trinidad expecting there to be like white ghettos and black people over here. If you come to Trinidad, everyone's very mixed. It's a very, very mixed society with a tiny smattering of white ghettoism and poor. Yes, there's poverty as well. Of course there's poverty. It's a lot of poverty. But it's not, I wanted this love thing to be part of the book.
You make the point, though, that you have to choose. You can have history or love. Just unpack that for us.
Well, they get to a bit of a stalemate with that one, don't they? She says, you know, why does one have to win? We need to do better than this. And I'm with her that I think life has underestimated the power of his love and their bond, their loving bond. He's always throwing politics at her. And she's sort of saying, okay, we get here every time, you know, we get here every time. You can't love me because of the power structure between us. You're making it impossible to love. And I think they're stuck to a certain extent in the stalemate of the politics of banning, of putting a ban on love, you know.
Now, of course, David, whose journal we get most of the story from, is a local man, and he falls in love with the mermaid. I'm sure that there's not a particular spoiler there. I was wondering about, again, going back to this post-colonial theme, but about writing as a black man, and if that had been problematic in any way, not so much perhaps for you, because, of course, you write fiction and that's what it is, but for those responding to you.
Well, it has to do, again, with my positionality as a Caribbean human being. So imagine I was actually not Caribbean and I was a white woman of middle class, just writing a black character from a very different background. What I'm doing isn't that. I'm not doing that. I'm using my Caribbeanness, because if I'm, as a white woman in Trinidad, I'm a minority and all my friends, all my colleagues are brown and black. So I live, I mean, it's impossible for me to write a Caribbean novel that's got no black people in it, or brown people, or mixed race people, because it wouldn't be authentic. So my black characters come out of my lifestyle and my world where I live amongst black people and my friends and my family's friends and colleagues and schoolmates, and every single person I see or speak to is brown or black. Do you see can you see the difference?
I can see the difference, but it's something I struggle with myself as a white African, also growing up in similar circumstances, and feel that my voice is very much constrained.
I got through that. And I also write Caribbean white people. I don't write English white people. All the characters in The Mermaid, for example, all my books, composite characters of people I know. But yeah, for me, I do it through my knowledge of place, language, culture, and people. So that lessens the race element, and it puts me more in a position of, okay, could I write a man? Could I write a man? Of course I could write a man. Could I write another black Caribbean man? It becomes easier because of my understanding of the culture. I do get what the red flags are. I do understand the complexities of the difference between someone like me and someone like David. If I didn't understand them, this book couldn't work. It wouldn't work.
And of course, you can also write as a fish or a half fish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Tell us about the mermaid. I mean, she is magnificent when she comes from the sea, and you feel just you give us that there's no fairy tale stuff here. There isn't, you know, her long golden hair. She's barnacled. She's full of sea lice and all the rest of it. Tell us a little more about her.
Well, that's just me getting to do what I do best, which is using my imagination. And, you know, I wanted her to be tremendous and magnificent and awesome, you know, a mixture of Shakti and Aphrodite and, you know, of the, you're pulling, you know, Kali out of the sea, you're pulling a big, dangerous, awesome woman creature fish, you know, you are pulling something out of the sea that, you know, you shouldn't be pulling out of the sea. And, you know, when she's a woman, she's smaller, isn't she? She's a smaller woman. She's how she was. But when she was a fish, you know, she's a tremendous mermaid, muscular, big, you know, half of her, when she loses her tail, she loses almost half her identity. So, you know, I just allowed my imagination off the leash, really.
And it's just beautifully done. And then when she is a woman too, we get this sense of her, how ancient she is and how this terrible curse has followed her for thousands and thousands of years.
So there's a book that did really help light the way for me around her consciousness, and that was William Golding's... it's called The Inheritors, and I teach it actually at Manchester Met, and it's written from the point of view of a pre-verbal Neanderthal man who uses telepathy, and they have a very simple, unsophisticated persona and consciousness. You don't really have access to his thoughts. And that book really lit the path of, if I was also writing an ancient person, an ancient human, what would that person's consciousness be like? What would they implicitly understand, and what wouldn't they understand?
There's an element of magical realism in it too, and I believe Marquez was an influence.
Always an influence, Marquez. But, what would I say about Marquez? All the magical realists, all the reading I've done over the last 20 years, Caribbean literature, Latin American literature. I mean, the other thing is that you're either going to open this book or you're not, because it's about a mermaid. So it's magical real from the get-go. It hasn't got magical real components. It is completely magical real.
Now, Monique, this book was published by Peepletree Press, and that in itself is special.
Yeah. Well, Peepletree are a contemporary canon of Black British and Caribbean writing, and have been going for 40 years. And they're also a repository for backlists and backdated literature for many people of the region who are now dead or even alive, really. And they're also a family. I mean, what Jeremy Ponton has created and Hannah Bannister have created is a kind of, well, a centre of excellence and, you know, a kind of a place of merit. I mean, they are extraordinary. Yeah. It was a great place to be, the right people to publish this book, definitely.
And then the other thing that struck me, because we're friends and so I obviously follow you on social media and we communicate from time to time, is how much personal effort you put into publicising this book.
Oh, yeah. So I decided to crowdfund to raise enough money to pay for a posh publicist. And I believe I'm the only writer so far to have ever tried this and succeeded in doing it. And yeah, it was a moment. There was a moment when a couple of very well-known writers said to me, "Don't do it. Don't do it. You know, it won't look good. Or, you know, you're not a worthy cause. You're not a charity." But I did it anyway. I mean, I just wasn't. I mean, part of me thought this might be the last book I ever write. You know. So I'm doing it. I'm going ahead and doing it. I want this book to have the kind of firepower that if it had been published by Faber or if it had been published by God knows, you know, I wanted to give this book what it deserved. So I went ahead and crowdfunded. Yeah.
And you then had the help from the publicist, but you also drove a great deal of it yourself. I mean, you have, for instance, your Instagram, lots of these wonderful pictures of mermaids from all over the world.
Oh, yeah. So there was, I mean, if you do a crowdfunder, you have to pledge and Yeah, so there was a huge amount of artwork that I had found from the region, which was all over. So if you were a friend on any platform, you'd have seen a lot of mermaids. But also, if you crowdfund, it's not like you're asking people for money, you're trading. So I offered people a chance to be edited by me. I had merchandise made up, mermaid handbags, books, people donated books. So I had a lot of help from PeopleTree and from, you just have to do what you can and offer what you can. And, some people, one person I know quite well, he says, I'm really broke, but I'll give you a fiver. And I'm like, that's great. Fiver's great. And somebody else, £200 or £300, fantastic.
Brilliant. Well, it absolutely paid off. Finally, Monique, what happens next? I mean, you've had this major win. It obviously does put you, as we discussed earlier, in a completely different league. Does it make your next book all that much harder?
No. Weirdly, there is going to be another book and there will be some big news coming in future weeks on different fronts. So I actually can't say what's going to happen next because I'm not allowed to. But watch the space.
Fantastic. The Mermaid of Black Conch is published by PeopleTree Press and it's by Monique Roffey. Monique, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thanks, Georgina.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull and Charlie Filmer-Court. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.